So now we're going to have the traditional sort of biologist talk with a mind-numbing array of PowerPoint slides. And this is the topic. So these are the two heroes of this work. So Qinling Guo is someone who has one of the more complicated educational histories of anyone I know. He did an MD in Taiwan, a master's in electrical engineering, and was finally set free by his family to do a PhD in theoretical physics with Herb Levine at UCSD. And so he came to the lab having never done a biological experiment, and as a theorist, but he actually did quite a lot of the experiments I'm going to show today. This is Mathieu Piel, who did his PhD with Michel Bournet at the Institut Curie in Paris, where he became a very good microscopist and cell biologist, but he also went to the Ecole Polytechnique, so he knows a little more math and physics than the average biologist. And to me, this is an example of the sort of thing that should be happening more and more over time, is that these two people came from very different perspectives. They did something together which neither one of them could have accomplished alone. And in retrospect, it's very unclear to any of the three of us at which points in this process experiment was leading theory and vice versa. Okay. So one view of mating in yeast, yeast has two sexes, and I'll show them to you in a second, is that this is just a prototypical eukaryotic signal transduction cascade or molecular network, I guess, in the theme of this workshop. And it exists, therefore, for people who like to study networks, and you can buy mating factor, apply it to the outside of the cells, go through this MAP kinase cascade, and study two convenient endpoints, the ability of signaling to arrest the cell cycle in G1, and its ability to induce genes involved in mating, so that, for example, FUS1 is a protein that's involved in the act of the two cells fusing with each other, and you can hook this gene's promoter to GFP, and you can monitor the expression of that gene. And it's our contention that although those are interesting things to study, this is not, in fact, the biological purpose for which this pathway was evolved. In other words, it wasn't evolved for cell biologists to study signaling, but it has a more fundamental role, and that's illustrated here. So yeast come in two sexes. They're called A and alpha. That difference is controlled by an allele at a single locus called the MAT locus. And that locus encodes transcription factors, which turn on one set of genes in A cells and a different set of genes in alpha cells. A cells make this red cloud here, which is A factor, which is a small peptide pheromone. Alpha cells make the green cloud, which is alpha factor, which is a 12 amino acid pheromone. It doesn't have any post-translational modifications, and so you can buy this compound and add it in very controlled doses. Exposure to the pheromone, so A cells have alpha factor receptors, and alpha cells have A factor receptors, induces the cells to arrest in G1 and to form these specialized mating projections. So this is called a shmoo, after a character in a 1940s cartoon. And these grow towards each other. The secretion of the pheromones, in fact, the secretion of everything, is polarized towards the tip of the shmoos. And eventually, these two cells fuse with each other. And experiments by Lee Hartwell in the late 1980s and early 1990s were the first things that hinted that this is really a conversation of the following sort. Words that some of you may have uttered on Friday night from time to time. Okay? And so the cells communicate with each other by secreting pheromone back and forth. So, for example, exposure of cells to pheromone induces them to secrete more of their pheromone. Okay, so there's some sort of progressive escalation of signaling. And so what Mathieu and Qinling were interested in doing was to try and understand what it is about this pathway that helps cells to mate with each other. So I'm going to give you a little bit, I'm going to give you the absolute minimum of the molecular details of how this pathway works that are required to help understand what's going on. So here's the ground state of the system. This is the alpha factor receptor. It's a protein that spans the membrane 7 times. It's a member of a large superfamily of receptors. This is a trimeric G protein. It's held to the membrane by a fatty modification on one of its subunits. And the alpha subunit is bound to GDP. And under these conditions, the 3 subunits are associated. The binding of pheromone induces conformational changes in the pheromone receptor. That induces it to interact with the trimeric G protein. And that interaction persuades the alpha subunit to swap GTP for GDP. That induces the beta and gamma subunits to dissociate. And in yeast, at least, it is the beta and gamma subunits that do most of the signaling. And they do that by recruiting two scaffolds. So this one is called FAR1. It's also involved in cell cycle arrest. It recruits a small G protein called CDC42. And CDC42, in turn, in its GTP bound form, stimulates indirectly a class of proteins called formins, and the formins nucleate the polymerization of actin. CDC42 also triggers the activation of a protein kinase called CDC20, and this phosphorylates a protein called steryl 11, and these three proteins here, steryl 11, steryl 7, and phos3, are part of a MAP kinase cascade. So steryl 11 phosphorylates steryl 7, steryl 7 phosphorylates steryl 3, and these three proteins are recruited to the surface of the plasma membrane because their scaffold protein, steryl 5, also interacts with the beta and gamma subunit. Okay? There is a positive feedback in this pathway because CDC42, when it stimulates actin polymerization, stimulates the delivery of proteins on secretory vesicles, which in yeast move along actin, and those carry with them things like the pheromone receptor, and associated with the surface, proteins like CDC42 and the beta-gamma subunit, which are held to the membrane by lipid modifications. So you signal, you recruit more signaling factors. So at a constant pheromone level, you do more signaling, you recruit, make more actin, recruit more signaling factors. This is a positive feedback loop. You need to turn this response off after the pheromone has left. There are two ways of doing that. This protein here, of course, SST2 stimulates the hydrolysis of GTP on the alpha subunit, and when it's hydrolyzed back to GDP, it binds the beta and gamma subunits, terminating signaling. And cells also secrete a protease called BAR1, or A cells at least secrete a protease called BAR1, and BAR1 degrades alpha factor. All the experiments I will talk about in the first half of the talk use cells where this gene has been deleted. Okay, and we delete this gene because if you don't delete it, you don't know what the alpha factor concentration is in your experiment because this is busy chewing up the alpha factor. Yes? No. This exists purely for mating. And we'll come, most of the second half of the talk, or the last third, will be about why this protein is important for mating to work normally. But essentially, all the experiments that people have done on signal transduction, they delete this protein, whose only known role is it's an A-specific protein, it's not expressed in alpha cell, whose only known role is to degrade alpha factor. And people usually delete it because if you don't delete it, you can't actually know what the pheromone concentration, or you don't know that the pheromone concentration you added is the one that the cells are exposed to. Okay? Yes? Well, these are two different molecules. This pathway. Yeah, but this protein has to get activated. Okay. It's activated by C. This is a member of what's called the PAC class of kinase, small G protein activated protein kinases.
So suppose you can have the SP5 and
not very much. Okay, so the belief is this is a local concentration effect. You can drag these proteins to the membrane by other means and get them activated. Without the beta gamma. It's to hold steryl 5 close to the plasma membrane. To recruit steryl 5 to the region of the plasma membrane. To increase the local concentration of steryl 11, 7, and plus 3 near where steryl 20 is active.
But the effect on signaling is very
Yeah, the effect on signaling is profound. I mean, this is a sterile gene. You knock this thing out, the cells don't respond to pheromone. Yeah, the effect's profound.
So there is a business of MT5, but I'm wondering about the interaction between MT5 and gamma beta. So suppose you didn't have a scaffold, but you tethered it to a plasma membrane like something other than... If you cut
gamma beta and you put something else on sterile 5 that will recruit it to the membrane, you will activate signaling. Okay? Still in response to the pheromone. Okay. So this is what this actually looks like. This is an A cell, this is an alpha cell. These cells are going to grow towards each other, they'll meet, they'll fuse, and they'll produce a bud, which is a diploid cell over here. So here we go. Boom. And there's the bud. So that this is a lot of this is a sort of Yogi Berra talk on the theme that you can observe a lot by just watching. So it's been known, well, let me say this piece first, although chronologically this is something people showed second. So in 1993, Jeff Segal showed that if you expose cells to a pheromone gradient, which is made by setting up a micropipette out of whose tip alpha factor dribbles, setting up by diffusion a concentration gradient. So that's what this pink shading is. The cells will orient their schmooze up that pheromone gradient. So that's a direct demonstration that these cells can detect and respond to pheromone gradients. If you expose the cells to uniform fields of pheromone, spatially uniform, it had been known, in fact, for many years previously, that they would still form schmooze. So this is an example of something that's quite common in biology, that you can stimulate cells with uniform fields, and yet they will polarize along one axis. These cells appear to polarize in random directions with respect to each other, but they're not polarizing in two directions at once or three. They're polarizing in one direction. And so the first thing that we wanted to ask about, and what Chin Lin in particular wanted to illuminate, was how is it that cells uniformly stimulated can polarize? And so before I talk about that, I just want to point out some of the differences between chemotaxis. So I'm sure many of you have heard about bacterial chemotaxis, studied by many people, including Howard Berg and Stan Leibler. And I just want to draw a contrast between some of the properties of that and mating. And we argue that mating is a general example of something that I will call target cell finding. So that there are situations in biology where cells are looking for something where they don't know exactly what it will look like or how far away it will be, which is what most of the chemotactic things do. And then there are situations where cells involved in various decisions in development, and I will point out that yeast mating is a form of developmental biology, know what they're looking for, and it's a question of finding targets where a substantial amount is known about what those targets look like. So here are the differences. Chemotaxis is fast because the cells can swim or crawl. Mating is slow, as is, for example, the finding of a plant ovule by a pollen tube, because all the cells can do is grow. They don't actually get to move their center of mass by moving the whole cell. These things act over long ranges, so your food source might be far away. These target-finding things tend to be local. If the targets are far away, it essentially guarantees you have to be able to deal with shallow gradients, where the difference between the front and back of the cell in terms of concentration divided by the mean concentration is on the order of 1% or even as little as 10 to the minus 3. If you have two cells that are touching each other and one of them is a sphere emitting pheromone uniformly, the difference between front and back is on the order of 0.5. And so these are steep gradients. These things have fast adaptation because cells have to rapidly adapt to the local mean concentration so they can tell if the concentration in one direction is higher or lower. Effectively, in mating, there is very little adaptation to continued exposure to a concentration of the pheromone. That is, the output of the signaling pathway doesn't appear to change over time if you keep the pheromone concentration the same. And the last thing is that it's often true in this case that cells have to pick a target. So if we use the Friday night at the singles bar analogy, you could be faced with two people who are attractive to you sitting on two bar stools. Well, at least at the beginning of the evening, they're equally attractive. At the end of the evening, if you simply fall face forward between the two bar stools, rather than ultimately turning towards one of them or the other, it will be a bad night. And the same is true for yeast cells, maybe. Okay. So what do we look at in these experiments? So this is the yeast cell division cycle. This is a cell which is about to bud. This is the bud. This is as it's about to divide. And this is a shmoo. I've illustrated the distribution of three proteins, although this magenta one, it's only been illustrated for one cell. So these are SPA2, which is a component of something called the polarisome, which is involved in helping to control the local positioning of actin filament nucleation. This is a protein called CDC10, which is a member of a multi-protein complex called the septins. This forms a ring often around sites of polarization, and it forms a ring around the point where cells are going to divide. And last but not least, these magenta things are actin cables. They're made up of multiple actin filaments bundled together. And so we look at all of these things by tagging them. So we tag them with fluorescent proteins, we look at a septin CDC10, we look at SPA2. We visualize the actin cables with a protein called ABP140, which binds to the side of actin cables. And we take all of these proteins, we couple them to various different fluorescent proteins, we expose the cell to pheromone, we look under the microscope, and we see what happens. So the first question, I'll remind you, is that we want to ask how it is that cells polarize in a unique direction. And the first model comes from old observations from John Chant and Ira Herskowitz. And what they showed was that if you look at a yeast cell that is budding, you can tell where the next bud will appear. And in particular, the next bud will appear right next in a haploid cell to where the last bud appeared. And there's a whole elaborate system of proteins involved in this historical progression of marks that tells cells where to bud based upon where they last budded. And so the first hypothesis to explain how they shmoo in a uniform field is that you simply use that same mark. And in fact, Doran Hartwell, around 1995, did experiments which led them to propose exactly that model. That this information that is going would have been used to tell a cell where to bud had it not been exposed to pheromone is used to tell it in which direction to shmoo. The second class of models is derived from a suggestion in 1953 of Alan Turing. And this is what are called lateral inhibition models. And their central feature is that you have a stimulus. It activates an activator. There is a positive feedback loop that triggers the production of more activator. The activator diffuses over a relatively short range. It leads to the production of an inhibitor, which diffuses over a longer range, so it has a higher diffusion coefficient. And the result of that is that if you apply a uniform stimulus to such a system, you can get zones of activation in a sea of inhibition. So this can, for example, in mathematical models, account for the pattern of seashells in the hands of people like George Oster. It's believed to account for the salt and pepper appearance of the precursors to nerve cells on the ventral surface of a Drosophila embryo and things like that. So it's a rather general model for producing regularly spaced cells of type A in a sea of cells of type B, but it is also true that it can, in systems where the length scales are right, produce a single zone of activation. However, in such systems, the tendency is that as you increase the stimulus, you decrease the effective length scale of the inhibition, and you tend to move to a situation like this one where you have multiple regularly spaced zones of activation. So this is obviously not what we see in yeast cells treated with pheromone. This class of model also predicts that active zones repel each other if they don't eliminate each other. And in particular, it predicts that if you stimulate cells uniformly, you should in principle get a transient response because the activator will go up and then the inhibitor will go up. Now, you can in that situation get ringing or some sort of damped oscillation, but you shouldn't get a sustained response. So the third class of model is one that Chin Lin invented, and it appeals to a cytoskeletal polymer, in our case actin, to signaling molecules that can be delivered to the membrane and activated by an external stimulus, for example, like the pheromone receptor. And the idea that those signaling molecules are delivered in their inactive form inside vesicles that are transported on these filaments. And the last important feature is that the signaling molecules, when they're active, stimulate filament polymerization, creating a positive feedback system. So you can imagine a cell like this, which is uniformly stimulated. You're delivering these filaments in this case, you're delivering the vesicles. In this case, the filament density is equal in all directions. If we posit that vesicles move along the filaments for a while, hop off, pick a different filament to move along, they will, over their time on the way to the surface of the membrane, sample all different transport directions, and they will go in a direction which is determined by summing up these vectors. In this case, the sum of these vectors is zero, and vesicles will just take a random walk to the surface of the membrane. Because of stochastic fluctuations in either the density of ligand or the density of signaling molecules, you can get a situation like this where all of a sudden there is more signaling on one side of the cell than the other. There's now a net transport vector in this direction because you stimulate more actin over here. And as a result of that, this becomes a self-reinforcing system. The tendency that fights this is the fact that these signaling molecules can diffuse in the plane of the membrane. So this system has a threshold. When the inhomogeneity is strong enough, or the stimulus allows strong enough positive feedback, you can fight diffusion and polarize the system. Below that threshold, diffusion just wipes out any transient inhomogeneities. So the good thing about this model is it produces a very robust drive to polarize along a single axis. Okay? And the system doesn't want to polarize along multiple axes at high stimulation. And if you get two zones of activation, you create a net transport vector that points between them, and you tend to bring these zones of activation together. Its con is that in a very general way, the drive to polarize the fact there is an intrinsic drive to polarize makes gradient detection fragile. And there's a very general prediction, which is that cells should be able to detect the direction of gradients most precisely at precisely the pheromone concentrations where, if they were in a uniform field, they would be on the threshold of polarizing. Okay? Because now, in effect, the biasing force of the gradient is bigger than any stochastic inhomogeneity that's likely to arise. So this is just a summary of that. So the historical mark predicts there's some... So this is stimulation here. This is transport efficiency along the cytoskeleton here. There's a zone where there's no polarization. Then there's a zone where there's single polarization. The direction of that polarization is totally predictable if you know what the historical mark is. In lateral inhibition, there's no polarization. There's one axis, and there are multiple axes. And the dynamics are that if you get a situation where two patches appear, they should repel each other. Global integration predicts weak stimuli, no polarization. Intermediate stimuli, at least transiently, you can see multiple patches. But the dynamics of these should be that their transport vectors should interact and they should swing towards each other and merge. This one? The length scale in this is that as long as the cytoskeletal filaments are as long as the cell, this system should integrate successfully. And in fact, we can use inhibitors of actin polarization to make the length scale shorter and suppress the formation of single patches so that we can actually get lots of cells that look like this. Okay? But as far as we know, that's the important length scale for this model. Okay? Because the model here... So the difference is... Here, this is just a mark, right? There's nothing fancy about this. The simplest form of lateral inhibition is one where the inhibitor is virtual. The inhibitor is just the depletion of a cytoplasmic pool of activator. Okay? And in that sense, what dominates the behavior is a scalar addition where what you're worried about is the original pool of activator in the cytoplasm minus the component that's on the membrane. Okay? Whereas in this case, you actually deal with the vector sum between the different transport things. And the primary thing there means that it just means those vectors have to be able to exert their force across the length scale of the cell. So this is just to show you that there is a narrow range between which cells bud and which they shmoo, which is not directly relevant to any of the things I just showed you on the last slide. This is an experiment where we vary the concentration of alpha factor over roughly 1,000 folds, so this is a logarithmic scale. This is the percentage of the cells that do different things. The red cells shmoo, the green cells bud. There's a very sharp transition between these two behaviors. If you plot this as a log-log plot, you get a Hill coefficient of about 6. And this behavior happens well below the dissociation factor of the receptor. Okay? And it suggests there must be some threshold behavior that dictates the difference between budding and shmooing here, whose nature we don't understand. So now coming back to the models, here's the first model, the model of the historical marks. So when a cell has just divided, there are two little spots of SPA2, and they tell you roughly where the cell will bud next. So this cell, one cell would bud here, the other cell would bud here. So we can record where those positions are in a movie. We can apply pheromone, and we can ask, when the cells shmoo, what's the angle theta between where we expected them to bud and where they've shmooed? And then we can plot the mean value of cos theta. This is what it looks like if there's no pheromone, so this verifies the results of many other people, that cells like to bud next to where they've last budded. This is the concentration in the last slide where everyone buds. This is where everyone shmoos. This is where Dora and Hartwell did their experiments, where it is indeed true that cells tend to shmoo towards where they would have budded. But as you'll see later, this is a wildly unphysiological concentration of pheromone. But in the physiological region, the physiologically important region, which you're about to see runs from something like 0.7 to 3 or 4 nanomolar pheromone, the cells do not bud in the direction of the place that you would have expected them to bud. If anything, they bud away from that. We believe that this difference down here reflects a shielding effect in this area here because cells take up pheromone, so the concentration may be a little lower. But anyway, there's no evidence that cells are using this site in order to shmoo. So here's an experiment where we take cells. They're marked with two things. The CDC42 is coupled to GFP. The CDC10, the septin, is coupled to a red fluorescent protein. These are the images as alpha factors being added. And what we do for the succeeding images is we actually subtract this fluorescence from what we see in the cell. So this is the fluorescence of a cell at this time point minus this fluorescence, leaving this little bit of CDC42 here. And so what you can see, and time zero here is the time where the shmoo started growing in one direction, the time at which polarization was first morphologically visible. So you can see two things. First of all, based on the overlay here, that the distributions in space of the septin and CDC42 are closely correlated. And secondly, that before the cell polarizes, these distributions move around. In particular, there are two patches here and here. They get closer together. They merge, and the cell eventually starts to grow in this direction. Okay? So at low stimulus, we see the merging of patches before cells polarize. This is what happens at high stimuli. This is a slightly different sort of image. This is a bright field micrograph. and this is a cell labeled with SPAR2, and it's stimulated. The last cell was stimulated with an intermediate concentration of pheromone, 2 nanomolar. This cell is strongly stimulated. This is 10 nanomolar pheromone. And what you're going to see the cell do is shmoo repeatedly in different directions. And the key thing is that when it's doing that, it's only ever trying to polarize in one direction at any one time. So here you see the tip of the shmoo growing in this direction. It stops, a new shmoo appears, a new tip appears, a new tip appears, and last of all, a tip appears again down here. Okay? So there's no hint of simultaneously activating multiple portions of the cell surface the way a lateral inhibition model would predict. Well, it's being distributed homogeneously, presumably, right? Yeah. So let me emphasize this. This phenomenon, again, which has been observed by many others before, which is that at high pheromone concentrations, the cells shmoo repeatedly. And in fact, Mathieu showed that the frequency or the interval between the formation of successive tips goes down as the pheromone concentration goes up. This is not explained by any of these models. It requires the biologist's typical sort of hand-waving model. We have that sort of model. We believe that the septin inhibits actin polymerization and the activation of CDC42, right? And it also inhibits the growth of the cell wall. And it basically is deposited behind the growing tip. But sometimes its deposition catches up to the growing tip and effectively closes it off. Okay? And so then the SPAR2 dissociates, and then actin polymerization gets focused somewhere else in the cell. Okay? But I want to emphasize that the model that we're retailing here does not predict that. This requires extra moving parts. Right? And the purpose of showing this, although it obviously draws your attention to this interesting behavior, is primarily to show that even though all sorts of interesting things are going on, the prediction of lateral inhibition that in strongly stimulated cells you might expect to see multiple zones of activation at the same time does not appear to be borne out. Okay. So this is an experiment where Chinlin labeled the actin filaments by expressing ABP140, this actin binding protein, fused to YFP. So this is the time at which pheromone is added. The cell starts to shmoo, so the tip is growing in this direction here. And here are time points taken 5 minutes apart. And what you can see is it looks like these cables. And I want to emphasize the cable is made up of many individual actin filaments. The individual actin filaments are actually shorter than the length scale of the cell. These cables appear to zip up and then spread apart. And most importantly, they seem to be moving inside the cell. And that impression is strengthened here by the movie. So this movie is looping through. And you can see that this is the tip of the shmoo from which the cables emanate, and it looks a little bit like Julia Child's whipping up a French omelette. Okay? And this sort of movement will certainly help to integrate transport throughout the cell, because it's like the filaments are fishing for vesicles and trying to bring them towards the tip of the cell. And so one of the things I'm not going to show you is that movement is substantially more rapid than the time scale in which the things that we believe are the cargoes of vesicles are transported from one side of the cell to the other. And the rate at which they would get from one side of the cell to the other if they moved continuously along a cable is also much shorter. And we believe this is consistent with the assertion that the vesicles move short distances along filaments, fall off, and then try other filaments and are effectively integrating the direction of transport over time. Okay, Boris. Sure.
So there's an interesting thing like that, but there's a fixed view at the bottom there.
This is the tip of the shmoo, right.
So that's where the green stuff was.
That's where the green stuff was.
And now when you do shmoo, that thing will get stuck somewhere else, and we'll have to turn the tail, and that's why the green stuff will disturb capital, because that thing will stop.
That's the assertion, and the things will get taken away. Right. I mean, also, all these things have off rates from the memory. So when you stop delivering things, if you stop delivering things, they disappear because things fall off the membrane with some dissociation constant. Right. And in the slides that I wasn't planning to show, there are examples of cells treated with low and high doses of pheromone. This is a cell treated with lowish doses or medium doses of pheromone. In the cells that are treated with high doses, these cables are turned back on each other, so the back half of the cell has none at all. And we think that that's what allows it to stimulate new growth there and sort of take over from the old schmoo. Okay? These cells are attached to a cover slip, but we don't think that. I mean, that's just for convenience for us so that we can observe them. We don't think there's anything to do with it. The cells, we're rather ignorant of the natural history of our organism, so we don't know what it looks like when it's happening in the wild. In the lab, they can mate on the surface of a plate, and they're probably really mating in a thin film of fluid on an agar surface. As far as we know, this doesn't move the cells, but I don't think we've ever... People have never seen movement that would obviously be consistent with internal movement of these things creating enough torque to turn the cells on. Okay. So one of the strong predictions of this model is that gradient detection should be fragile and that it should be best around the concentration of cells, the concentration of pheromone where cells can just polarize in the absence of a gradient. And that concentration is around 1 nanomolar pheromone. That's the sort of threshold for polarization. So what I'm going to show you now is experiments done by Mathieu. And this uses microfluidic technology to create defined pheromone gradients. So the principle, and these experiments were done in collaboration with Justin Zhang, who was a postdoc in George Whiteside's lab in the chemistry department. And the principle is very simple. You have two flows here that come together. One contains pheromone, the other does not. They meet in this chamber. They meet in a regime where flow is laminar, so there's no diffusion. There's no convection or turbulence. And as a result of that, pheromone diffuses from the pheromone-containing flow to the one that lacks pheromone. And as you go down the chamber, the gradient gets shallower and shallower, but at any given point, this gradient is stable over time. And if you are careful, and Mathieu was extremely careful about this, you can set up things like this so that the pheromone gradient will be stable over many hours. And you can set up a microscope so you can go and look repeatedly at the same field, and you flip from field to field, and you can collect a lot of data quite quickly. Okay. So here's just a reminder of the predictions of this model. Here's a cell where vesicle transport is equal in all directions. There's a stochastic fluctuation which makes it stronger in one direction. Diffusion tends to fight that inhomogeneity, but beyond a threshold where you can exceed diffusion by transporting stuff fast enough, you will in fact polarize the cell. And so what that predicts is that there should be concentrations where it takes cells a long time to polarize in response to a uniform field, and they will polarize faster in response to a gradient. And so this is effectively an anecdotal example. I mean, that turns out to be generally true, but this is a set of images. So the top set of images comes from cells treated with a uniform concentration of pheromone, which is 1 nanomolar. The bottom come from cells treated in a way where the mean concentration across the cell body is 1 nanomolar. But there's a gradient, and the slope of that gradient between the front and the back of the cell is about 10%, and the high concentration of pheromone is over on this side. These are images taken every 20 minutes. This is looking at SPA2 coupled to a fluorescent protein. The contrast relative to the other images has been inverted, so white is now black, so this black spot is where the SPA2 is more concentrated. And so what you can see is in the absence of pheromone, the SPA2 is jumping all over the place. There are periods where there are two spots. There are periods where there's one. So it goes, time goes like this, and then starts again down here. So it looked like the cell was going to polarize, but now it's down here, now it's up here. And finally, it starts to polarize in one direction, although there's still some instability in terms of where the SPA2 is most concentrated. And eventually you get it more concentrated, and the cell is clearly shimmering in this direction. This is a pair of cells, a mother and a daughter. And you can see that it now takes much less time to align and orient the SPA2 in a direction where the orientation is stable. Okay, so this, we should compare this time point here with this one up there. And now the cells have started to shmoo and they're growing stably up the gradient. Okay, so we're making it take less time for them to shmoo, and they are in fact shmooing in the right direction. So what I'm going to show you now is three things. I'm going to show you a cartoon, a movie, and then a graph which quantifies the accuracy with which cells detect gradients. So this is the cartoon. This is the flow of pheromone would be in this direction. So we're looking at a cross-section of the chamber. The gradient runs from low here to high here. These cells are at a pheromone concentration that is so low that they don't really know there's pheromone there. They randomly bud relative, they bud in random directions relative to the orientation of the gradient. These cells show directed budding up the pheromone concentration gradient. These guys arrest and grow larger and larger without polarizing. These guys, and this is an earlier version before we got the concentrations actually worked out. This concentration range extends from 1 nanomolar actually to about 4 nanomolar, not 8 nanomolar as it's written here. These cells shmoo up the gradient in the right direction, and at higher concentrations, the cells make multiple shmoos whose direction is uncorrelated with that of the gradient. So here's the movie. So what's going to happen in the movie, it will loop through repeatedly, but each time it loops through, these white circles will be moved to guide your attention to a different group of cells. So these cells are going to make buds, but those buds are going to go up the gradient. So if you look, that cell budded up the gradient, now this one does. These cells don't, they just get bigger and bigger. These are the lucky cells that shmoo up the gradient. This cell started in the wrong direction but then turns up the gradient, and these are the hopelessly confused. Okay, so I'll let it loop through one more time. Butt up, basketballs, correct seekers after truth, turning, helpless. And so this just quantifies that data. So the green dots are for cells that are budding up gradients. The red triangles are for shmoos. And theta is the angle between the direction of the gradient and the direction of polarization. This is the mean cosine of theta. And what you can see is there is a narrow range which peaks around 1 nanomolar over which cells detect the pheromone gradient accurately. Okay. So this is what the global integration model would predict, but it's a little biologically surprising. Okay, and it's biologically surprising in the following sense. We know that cells can mate with partners over a very wide range of conditions. We know that a pair of isolated cells where the diffusional sink for any pheromone that escapes is large will mate with each other. We know that very dense mixtures of cells where there are millions of A and alpha cells all plastered next to each other, where there's very little diffusional sink, will mate with each other. And we know that you can change, by genetic manipulation, the concentration of alpha factor which cells will mate, and they will still mate successfully with A cells. Interestingly, from the Hartwell experiments that deduce this evidence for courtship, we do know that in those situations, if you give A cells a choice of mating to alpha cells that make more or less pheromone, they will unerringly prefer to mate with the cells that make more pheromone. Okay? So there's a suspicion that this is some sort of genetic artifact. That is, these cells detect pheromone gradients over a narrow range. But the evidence from looking at sort of different conditions and genetic manipulation suggests that, cells can really mate in a wide range of conditions. And so I will remind you that all these experiments up to and including this point have been done in cells that do not express the alpha factor degrading protease BAR1, okay, for reasons of convenience. And so here's an illustration of the problem. And so this part of the talk depends on input from Nama Barkhai and her student Noah Rappaport, who had been doing, at least initially completely independently of us, theoretical analysis on what problem cells have to solve to detect rate. And the first point is a very simple one. So here's an alpha cell secreting pheromone. So there's a very pink haze, faint pink haze that may even be hard to see. So now what we just do is we just plaster those cells on top of each other and their pink hazes on top of each other. So here's 4, 16, 64. And you can see that the color is getting redder and redder, corresponding to more and more alpha factor. And that this is essentially a simple geometric argument. Imagine that the distance between an A cell and alpha cells of interest is R. Any given alpha cell's pheromone contribution to the concentration that the A cell experiences depends on 1 over R, because these are cells plastered on top of a thick plate, so they're effectively spherical emitters into a vast sink of material. Okay? But the number of contributing cells, as R increases, goes as R squared. Okay? So the total pheromone concentration from all its neighbors that the A cell feels should go with R as you look further and further out over a range of cells at constant intercell spacing, okay, which is effectively all this is. When there are 2 cells, there's less pheromone in the middle here than when there are 4. You look unhappy. Well, they're not degrading the pheromone yet, right? So if they didn't, so that's exactly the point. If they didn't degrade the pheromone, this is what would happen, right? So this implies they need to degrade the pheromone, right? And you can go further than that, and you can say that that degrading the pheromone is required to make the concentration it measures a local concentration rather than a global concentration, right? And if you do simulations of this, and you take account of the fact that some of the bar 1 is actually retained on the cell wall of the cell that secretes it. It means that the pheromone concentration at the surface of the cell scales roughly as the cube root of the rate of pheromone secretion from cells that are nearby, and the cells that are far away, it doesn't matter at all because the pheromone's all gotten degraded in transit. Okay. Right, so again, this is a straw man to explain why you need bar 1, right? This is what it would look like if there were no bar 1. No, it's not completely uniformly distributed. We'll talk about where it is on the surface. And it's secreted from a point on the surface once the cells are polarized, right? And we'll talk about the role of uniformly distributed bar 1 and bar 1 attached to the cell surface. So we can ask, how important is this effect? So this slide looks at the activity of the FOS1 promoter in individual cells. So the way Mathieu did this is the FOS1 promoter is hooked up to YFP, the cells are in the chambers, he goes by with a microscope, he records the cells every so often, he looks at the rate of increase in fluorescence over time as a measure of the activity of the promoter. Okay? And he does that at different pheromone concentrations, and so this is the result you get for the FOS1 promoter in cells that lack bar 1. And I'll emphasize this is, okay, so far so good. So this is a hyperbolic increase. The half maximal induction is around 3 nanomolar alpha factor, and then the response saturates. And this green zone here corresponds to the range of pheromone concentrations over which bar 1 delete cells polarized accurately up a gradient. Okay? This is what the response looks like in bar plus cells. We're shortchanging the bar plus cells a little bit because this happens in a flow chamber because we don't want the bar plus to perturb the overall pheromone concentration, so we keep washing away the secreted bar 1, so like I said, in effect, we're slightly shortchanging these cells. So this effect is primarily due to the bar 1 that is attached to the cell wall. And what you can see is this is still a hyperbolic slope. It just has a much higher, somewhere around 30 nanomolar concentration for half maximal activation. And this red zone here now corresponds to regions that give you the same pheromone response as was required to get this green zone here. So it suggests that these cells detect pheromone gradients over a much wider range. Yes?
Bar 1 has a certain
both. It's both. In this experiment, we're measuring the contribution of the stuff that's attached, because the stuff that is... But in the real world, it's both. Okay? The ratio between what fraction is one and one fraction is the other? No, not accurately. Okay? And it would be worth knowing. And it's probably knowable. But, I mean, I think we could do experiments, but we don't know what it is. I guess what I would say is I think probably the majority of it is secreted, but the concentration, because the volume in which it's retained in the cell wall is small, the concentration in the cell wall is probably much higher than the concentration in the surrounding media. Okay? But that doesn't tell you which fraction is which. Okay? And one way of its regulation is to make the production of bar 1 regulated in proportion to the amount of alpha factor the cell sees. So this experiment is done in a bar minus cell. Okay? So this is the bar 1 promoter hooked to YFP. Right? This is the data from the FUS1 promoter in bar minus cells, the one you just saw on the last slide. And what you can see is the bar 1 promoter is very strongly induced by pheromone, at least in these arbitrary units, more strongly than the FUS1 promoter. And in particular, it is induced at lower concentrations. Right? So the prediction would be that the transcription binding factor sites in the bar 1 promoter are either more numerous or tighter affinity than those in the FUS1 promoter. And actually, one of the things we want to go and do is do a little bioinformatics and to see if that's actually true. The sort of arguments that people like Uri have made in the just-in-time model, where the sequence of induction can be accounted for by essentially the integrated affinity over all the binding sites in the promoter. And so there is a problem, which I will explain a little later, in measuring the gradient sensitivity of bar plus cells, partly because they are making protease that is interfering with the gradient, and if that protease is non-uniformly located on the cells, you can have some bad things happen. So these experiments use steep gradients whose slope is above 30%. And in those gradients, this is bar minus, this is bar plus. These are ranges of pheromone concentrations, that is, ranges at the midpoint of the cell. This is the mean pheromone concentration. And you can see that the bar plus cells appear to do substantially better than the bar minus ones do. Okay? Explaining how mating can be robust, even though the intrinsic ability to polarize is fragile. Because what these cells are doing, unlike chemotactic cells, which regulate the ligand affinity, okay, to regulate the response, these cells are actually regulating the ligand concentration, so that the ligand concentration at the cell surface is different from the ligand concentration in bulk solution. And we'll come back again at the very end as to why they might do such a crazy thing. Okay. So, now I'm going to explain what the roles of soluble and insoluble bar 1 are. And I want to start by doing that by showing you that bar 1 really is important. So this is a mixture of, in green, A cells, and these are bar minus cells. In red, alpha cells. The dots indicate the location of SPAR2. What you can see, first of all, is that no one mated here, even though there are some A cells close to some alpha cells. And more importantly, that these A cells here, in the cartoon and up in the slide here, which are far away from any alpha cells, respond to the alpha cells in SHMU, but when they respond to them, this one, for example, is not going in the direction of those alpha cells over here. If you did a similar experiment with wild-type A cells, these cells, which are far away from... These A cells here, which are far away from a cluster of alpha cells, would have no response whatsoever. Okay? This is a slightly different assay. This is a mating assay. So we score the fraction of the bar minus A cells that manage to mate to an alpha cell. In every experiment, there is an equal number of A and alpha cells, but the variable we change is the fraction of those A cells that are bar minus. Okay? Or the way it's expressed here is the fraction that are bar plus. So when there are no bar plus cells in this mating mixture, the bar minus cells mate with an efficiency of around 1 or 2%. As you add And I remind you, we're looking only at the mating of the bar minus cells. We don't worry about whether the bar plus cells mate or not. As you add as little as 20% of bar plus cells, which are therefore supplying exogenous bar 1, a sort of haze of bar 1, you essentially completely rescue the mating of the bar minus cells. So this says that soluble pheromone can help you. But Moa and Nama's analysis suggests that there are situations that soluble pheromone does not particularly help them. So here's just a cartoon, or sort of the MATLAB cartoon. Here are two alpha cells. They secrete pheromone, and we add their, and the pheromone diffuses from a spherical emitter, and we add up the contributions from two cells, and so these are just contour lines of increasing pheromone concentration. So when the A cell is far away, it doesn't know there are two alpha cells. It's just thinking this is the mother of all alpha cells towards which it should polarize. As it gets closer to the point that it's here, the pheromone concentration is higher, either here or here, than it is down there, but this gradient is relatively shallow. Okay? And if I did this red shading in proportion to what the pheromone concentrations were, your eye couldn't detect the gradient. Okay? And Noah and Nama's analysis says that if you leave some of the protease on the cell wall, you can substantially sharpen this gradient, making it easier for you by appealing to stochastic variation to either mate to this cell or this cell rather than plunging towards the gap in between. Okay? And is bar 1 attached to the cell wall? So these are experiments done by Joanna Sa, who's a graduate student in the lab. So these again are fluorescent images where the contrast is inverted, so black is really white. This is an alpha cell which is invisible in these images. And here are three A cells that are courting it. And the A cells express bar 1 coupled to GFB. So this is not the bar 1 promoter, this is the bar 1 protein that's coupled to GFP. And what you can see is that as courtship goes on, the cell that's destined to mate with the alpha cell expresses more and more bar 1, and that bar 1, which is attached to the cell wall, is polarized towards the alpha cell. Okay? And the assertion is that one of the consequences of doing that is very little alpha factor escape, and the alpha factor secretion is polarized towards this point too. So that as these cells approach each other, the alpha factor has to go past a gauntlet of bar 1 molecules, with the effect that relatively little of it gets out to affect these potential competitors for mating. So if you like, one of the things it's doing is warding off the opposition. Right, but it depends.
So you don't want to start averaging for the inhabitants of those two different scales, right? So you just want to see one or the other. So that's
right, but you can shorten the length scale. It's easier to get the concentration of bar 1 high and shorten the length scale by retaining it on the cell wall than by letting it diffuse away. It is. And there are bad consequences of that, and I'll show them to you. Okay? So these are some images of cells actually mating in different conditions. So these are bar minus cells which are supplied with exogenous protease. And the exogenous protease is of two forms. It's either bar 1 that comes from nearby bar plus cells, or it's the addition of pepsin, which is the commoner garden protease to which bar 1 is most related by sequence, which you can just obviously buy from Sigma and spike in. So the A cells, their SPA2 is in green. Alpha cells, their SPA2 is in red. And here's a situation where A and alpha cells are going to mate unmolested by competitors. So this is cozy corner table. And so you see they align their SPA2 spots towards each other. And you can see that this alignment is very tight. And eventually the cells will mate, and this is their first bud produced here. Here's the situation that was diagrammed on the previous slide. So here are two alpha cells and one A cell. Okay? And what you're going to see this A cell do is head towards the gap between the alpha cells and actually polarize through it. And the alpha cells, being gentle people, their suitor having fallen off the bar stool in between them, turn around and give chase. And the more gentle personally of them manages to actually mate with the A cell. Okay, so despite Boris's argument that you should just be able to make the lengths go globally short enough that you can sort this out, in this case at least, supplying exogenous protease doesn't do the trick. Okay, this is the opposite situation here. So now we have an alpha cell and two A cells. Okay? The alpha cell turns towards one of the A's. Another A, at least in anthropomorphic terms, unaware that courtship is going on, also tries to get in on the act. Okay? And polarizes towards the alpha cell, which ultimately mates with the bottom cell, the one that is the first polarized towards. If you did the same experiment, or if we look in images like this where the A cells are bar plus, this cell, by the time these two cells are lined up like this, gives up and goes off and looks for someone else. Which is one of the things that leads us to assert that the local secretion of bar 1 and its retention in the cell wall means that effectively the vast majority of alpha factor either signals here or gets destroyed, so there's very little that escapes out here. And so this cell doesn't get a chance to muscle in as a competitor. Yes? These cells would be hopelessly confused because the pheromone, they would be seeing too much pheromone and they would not be able to detect a gradient at all. Yeah. Well, it's not all. I mean, when you add exogenous cells and you scan around on the slide, you can find things like this, and you can find things where the concentration of bar 1 is too low and they're still confused, right? I mean, these cells are the cells are randomly thrown down on the slide, and it depends on the distance of these bar minus cells from the nearby bar plus cells whether this works or not. Yeah, well, without bar 1, if the A cells are next to an alpha cell, there is they cannot reduce the pheromone concentration to a point where they can detect gradients at all. Right? And their mating efficiency is extremely low. So they make multiple repeated schmooze in random directions with regard to the cell that they in principle ought to mate with. Right, they're close. The pheromone gradient is very steep, but the mean concentration of pheromone is above the range in which they can detect gradients. Okay, in the absence of the exogenous protease. Okay, the biological response of the cells is saturated, and if it's saturated, they can't detect a pheromone gradient. Does that sound believable? Well, case two and case three are the inverse of each other, right?
But as far as the gradient is concerned, the point is, in either case, they can't.
Well, in this case, this cell is trying to distinguish between two identical partners, right? And can't do that. in this situation, this cell, which doesn't have two alphas to choose from, is doing fine, right? The difference here is that in wild-type situation, this cell would not be trying to get in on the act, okay? That even if initially its SPAR1 had started to localize in this direction, it would disappear, and this cell would repolarize in some other direction where the pheromone concentration was higher. Okay? So as Burris pointed out, this might not have been the best way to design a railroad. Okay? Because consider the following situation. Here are two alpha cells cording the front and back of an A cell. The A cell is polarizing its secretion of bar 1 and retaining some of the bar 1 in the cell wall, much more at this end of the schmoo than at this end of the schmoo. The result is that if that's true, the effective pheromone concentration should actually be higher at the back end of the cell. And you might expect that this cell would flip and now point in this direction. And actually, you might then expect that you would go backwards and you would keep doing it again and again. So there are two things about this. First of all, does anything like this ever happen? And the second is, if it does, what keeps it from happening all the time? So we believe that there are mechanisms that essentially, at a certain point, commit the cell and make this sort of flipping harder. But I think the important thing in terms of Boris's worry is to show that the thing that you're worried about, the cells themselves accidentally inverting the pheromone gradient, does happen. And when I said there are difficulties looking at bar plus cells in shallow pheromone gradients, that difficulty is that some of the time the cells start to polarize up the gradient, and then presumably because they secrete bar 1 and bar 1 gets stuck on the cell wall preferentially at the tip of the schmoo, they actually invert the gradient and turn around. Right? So here's a movie. So this is an A cell here, and its SPAR2 will be labeled in green. And this is one alpha cell, and this is another alpha cell, and these are the regions you should look at when the movie starts. Because what you're going to see, I'll tell you what you're going to see. You're going to see this A cell court this alpha cell, grow tired, and swivel its zone of polarization and mate with this cell here, exactly as this analysis predicts. So they, and now the green migrates, and this cell succeeds in mating. And so, if this were the right explanation of that, there are two predictions that would be statistically true. First of all, this behavior should be seen much more often when this is an A cell than when it's an alpha cell. That's true. And secondly, if you look in matings where there is exogenous bar 1 supplied, this should not happen because the cell should not be able to invert the pheromone gradient, and that's true too. So this is a description of where we are. And what we're interested in now are a variety of things. We'd like to understand what commitment really means. We'd like to understand what it is that eventually convinces the cell that it's safe to mate. So the point I'll make is because these cells have an elastic cell wall. And because of that, they can manage life being hyperosmotic relative to the medium in which they're suspended. And unlike our cells, which have to be isosmotic. But if you have a cell wall, you can't really fuse with someone else. So at the point where they're going to fuse, they have to degrade the cell wall. If you do that, in the absence of a neighbor, water will rush in and you will burst and die. So sex is at least as dangerous for yeast as it is for us. And one of the things we already know is that you can expose cells to as much pheromone as you want in a uniform field, and you cannot induce cells to burst. You can expose cells to very steep pheromone gradients. You cannot induce them to burst. And so there are a variety of different possibilities about what it is that triggers the cells to degrade their cell wall. They include the idea that signaling has to be very localized within the plane of the cell membrane. there's the potential that the cells could be responding to temporal variations in the pheromone concentration. So the pheromone is delivered to the membrane by vesicles. The vesicles fuse with the membrane at some rate. Guesstimates from people in the field are in the order of a hertz. If that's true, the concentration of pheromone at the surface of the cell goes up and down like this, and as you go further away because of diffusion, it's like this at the surface of the cell, and it goes like that. And in principle, you could use the peak to trough ratio to the amplitude as a ruler. Okay? This model is probably too elegant to be true, but it's at least a model. And the third model is that these two cells are like balloons, and as you push them against each other, you will change the wall stress in the balloon. And this is an example of why it's good to talk to physicists. We decided that as you push them together, you would reduce the wall stress, and we tested the effect of mutants that could detect that, and they certainly don't block mating. When we talked to an applied mathematician in the form of Mike Brenner, he pointed out to us that actually we were looking at the problem exactly the wrong way around, and this is you push the balloons together, you increase the wall stress in the area where they touch, and so we know the mutations that are involved in that sort of stress, and actually one of those mutations is already known to cause cells treated with pheromone to pop. So this is actually probably the leading candidate at the moment. There's not a huge number, and it's not, no one's ever actually tested, and we might go and do it, is to just look through the systematic deletion collection and see how many of them are killed by pheromone. These mutants are, the mutant in question is called MPK1. It encodes the MAP kinase most homologous to mammalian MAP kinases. And people played with it for other reasons. It turns out to have this property. There's one last thing that I'll say, which is none of you have asked about A factor, right? So presumably there should be a whole reciprocal system for dealing with A factor, and obviously one of the reasons I haven't told you about A factor is there is no such reciprocal system. And in fact, no one works in a laboratory with A factor for the following reason. That alpha factor is a 12 amino acid unmodified peptide. A factor is the same size plus or minus one amino acid. But it has a farnesyl group, which is a 20-carbon hydrocarbon group, pure hydrocarbon attached to its surface. Okay? And that hydrocarbon attachment is absolutely required for it to be biologically active. So the reason no one works with A factor is if you take a short peptide and put a big piece of grease on it, you can't dissolve it very effectively. Okay? And it sticks to the surface of every vessel you use, and you might as well, at least if you're trying to do biology, go stick your head in a microwave. And the interesting possibility is that the way that the pheromone concentration of A factor is regulated is not by this fancy regulated secretion of protease, but simply by partition, right? That when A factor concentration is above the desired threshold, the molecules, the excess molecules form micelles in which the all-important farnesyl group is stuck on the inside and they're just dead. And it's amusing that it looks, and I should say looks because the evidence is so far is very crappy, from sequence gazing in fungi, that this division between having one pheromone unmodified and the other modified by something that would act, at least in principle, as an effective upper bound on its concentration appears to have to be evolutionarily relatively old, and it's one of the things that we're interested in exploring. And with that, these are the dramatis personae. So Chinlin and Matthew did the vast majority of the work. I talked about the stuff on bar one was very much inspired and aided by conversations with Noah and Nama. Joanna and Tomas did some of the experiments, and Justin Zhang and George Whiteside's help with the microfluidics. Yes.
Okay, early on in your talk, you had a slide where you measured the angle between the butt and the shoe. And you found that in the relevant concentration range of pheromones, it was, well, not 180 degrees, but the cosine was negative.
Yeah.
Is there any evolutionary reason for it to be? Because I could propose two. One is not to choose towards your mother, probably doesn't make sense because you have the same size as you are. And the other is just two words, you know, in a place where it would be found by perspective space.
Yeah, I guess what we're worried about is in those situations where the pheromone concentration is low, and when pheromone binds to the receptor gets internalized and the pheromone effectively gets degraded. We're not looking just at some sort of shadow effect that has to do with geometry. Okay? In terms of mating with your mother, although that's frowned on in human society, in yeast, so yeast is very strongly inbreeding. So So what happens in nature is after the cells go through meiosis, you have four spores, of which two are A's and two's are alphas. Okay? And when cells start to germinate, these cells primarily mate with each other. And Mathieu has some very preliminary evidence that as they're germinating them, the wall of ascus is at best poorly permeable to pheromone. So one of the reasons for doing the crazy ligand concentration control is that if this is completely impermeable, no amount of adapting the ligand affinity will help you because the pheromone concentration will eventually become infinite in here. So you need to control the pheromone concentration. And so a lot of the time, these cells actually have committed to mate with each other and sometimes fuse before they escape from the ascus. So that's one way of inbreeding. So this is not mating with your mother, this is mating with your sisters. Okay, perhaps.
Yeah.
Right. If you fail to mate in this way, so now let us say you're an alpha spore. You divide to make two alpha cells. And when the mother of those two cells divides, she makes two A's. And the geometry of that is, remember I said, so here's the first cell division, mother and daughter. Remember I said cells like to bud close to where they last budded. So now, and so in this diagram, the granddaughters, right? So you're all, Kim Naismith made the argument that the haploid budding pattern is set up so that the combination of this process, which is called mating type switching and budding, sets you up for a perfect grand of incest. So unlike other organisms which have various sorts of genetic drives to outbreed, yeast appears to be the opposite. Okay? And actually that reminds me to say one other thing. So there are hints that what goes on in yeast may be more general for target finding cells. So there are a couple of situations in mammalian biology where people have recently shown that cells that respond to gradients only do so over a very narrow range, like fibroblasts responding to gradients of platelet-derived growth factors. And again, in at least one of those situations, it looks like there's a secreted protease that is involved in helping target finding. So this idea of having a mechanism that guarantees you polarize in one direction, which is what global integration does, coupled with a mechanism for controlling the ligand concentration to help make sure you discriminate between identical partners, maybe somewhat general in various developmental interactions, which are of this sort of target-finding mode where the cell in principle has a picture of what the target should look like.